House Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer says in his 33 years in Congress, they've never come back from summer break facing the number of critical issues they do now. This hour, the view from Iowa Congressman Dave Loebsack. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, a conversation with Representative Loebsack of Iowa's 2nd District. We'll ask if he could support a military strike on Syria. We'll also ask about the stalled farm bill, immigration reform, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and the next debt ceiling showdown. Then we'll hear about the so-called digital divide in terms of high-speed broadband. My guest, University of Iowa Professor Carolyn Tolbert. That's all coming up after a look at this news update. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the next 2 months, Congress will decide the fates of a president's power, a military strike, defense contracts, the budget, health care implementation, the Federal Reserve chairmanship, illegal immigrants, and possible debt default. House Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer told Politico, "In 33 years, we've never come back from summer break with a number of very critical, important issues that we're going to confront over the next 90 to 120 days. As elected officials return to Washington following the summer break, we want to check in with Iowa's congressmen and senators over the next few days to get their views on these issues. And first to join us today, Representative Dave Loebsack of Iowa's 2nd District. The district includes the cities of Davenport, Iowa City, Clinton, and Ottumwa. Congressman Loebsack, welcome, and thanks for coming into our studio today.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks, Ben.
You haven't been in Congress as long as Steny Hoyer, your colleague, but you have been deeply involved in politics for decades before you were elected as a professor of political science. Would you agree with him that when he says it's an amazing time for Congress you have before you?
Yeah, I read those comments myself yesterday, and I couldn't agree more. It is an amazing time, but it's an unfortunate time. We really shouldn't be at the point where there are so many things that have been left on the table for us to deal with by the end of the year. We left early August. John Boehner sent the House of Representatives home for 5.5 weeks. Personally, I think we should have stayed there at least a couple of those weeks, especially given the things that are on the table. The farm bill, I hope we'll be talking about today. That's the big one for Iowa in many ways. But a lot of these other issues that you've talked about, I think it's truly unfortunate that we were sent home for that length of time. And I think a lot of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle do feel the same way.
Let's talk about the news that is dominating the political landscape in many minds in across America. I want you to—let's talk about Syria. And yesterday, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee authorized limited military action in Syria. Can you react to that resolution approved by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee?
I did read the resolution yesterday. I think it's about 11 or 12 pages. And I have some concerns about that resolution, but I have concerns more generally about whether we ought to take military action in Syria or not. I am not convinced at this point that that is the right thing to do. I'm not sure that the American people are convinced either. I think we can all agree, and I think we all do agree, that it was absolutely hideous and repulsive what Mr. Assad did to his people. There's no question about what happened and who did it. I don't think anybody questions the veracity of the argument that it was Mr. Assad and he used chemical weapons. The real question is, what, if anything, can be done to prevent it and deter him in the future? And I understand and I accept that that's what the president wants to do. I think the world community truly would like to deter him from doing this again, prevent him from doing it again. The real question is whether there is a capability on the part of anyone to be able to do that. And then what the president is proposing, is that something that will in fact be effective and that it will accomplish the end, which is to try to prevent that from happening again? And the American people are not convinced yet, and I'm not sure that Congress is convinced yet.
What about you, Congressman? Are you supporting the president at this point? Are you undecided? Where are you?
I would say I'm definitely leaning in the no category because I'm unconvinced. I've had a number of briefings. I was just on with the president's chief of staff yesterday for about an hour while I was on the road. I have yet to see the evidence that what the president is proposing will in fact accomplish the goal that he has set out, and that is to deter and degrade the capabilities, at least, of this really hideous dictator. We can all agree with that. There's no question about that. But we have to make sure that whatever is done will, in fact, accomplish the goal.
So for you, it is really a practical matter, not a moral one, as we have heard from some leaders, perhaps John Kerry, that this is a moral imperative that we're facing to react somehow, not only for this consequence, what happens in Syria, but perhaps longer term, maybe concerning a country like Iran.
It is a moral imperative. There's no question about it. And the world is united in terms of doing what it can to prevent the use of chemical weapons now and in the future. There's no question about that. We're all repulsed by this. But then it is a practical question, too, as to what can be done to prevent this from happening in the future. Clearly, the world community, at least rhetorically, would like to see this never happen again. The question is, what is the world community willing to put behind the rhetoric in the event that the United States carries out this attack? I'm not convinced that there will be that many folks who will be behind the United States. And then domestically, clearly, we have to be thinking as well about the American people and what the American people think about this. And as an elected representative of the 2nd District of Iowa, I'm listening to folks. I have a poll right now on my official government website, lobsack.house.gov/Syrian. Folks can go and tell me what they think about this particular issue and what I ought to do next week when that vote comes up.
Mm-hmm. And all of our elected representatives have been hearing a lot from their constituents, no doubt, about this issue over the last few days. In comparison to other recent issues that you've faced in Congress, how would you characterize the number of people getting in touch with you in your office on this issue?
I think it's pretty high, and I've been getting around the district as I always do. I did 3 Labor Day events. This was the issue that came up. There were virtually no other issues that folks were talking to me about. This is a big one. You know, this is a war-weary nation. The president has acknowledged that. Secretary Kerry has acknowledged that. After 12 years at war, Afghanistan and Iraq, the country is weary. There's no question. And folks are not anxious to get involved in another conflict, however limited that may be, at least at the outset. I think people are very concerned about boots on the ground. They're very concerned about getting deeply involved in the Middle East. They're very concerned about potentially a wider conflict resulting from any action that we may take.
Mm-hmm. And we're seeing this in public opinions, polls. President Obama definitely facing an uphill battle, making the case for U.S. military action in Syria. The latest Pew Research poll, I'm sure you've had a look at it, conducted August 29th through September 1st, 48% to 29%. That margin, more Americans opposing than supporting conducting these military airstrikes against Syria. And also in the Democratic column, 29% of Democrats favor conducting airstrikes, 48% are opposed. Are you saying that this is similar to what you're hearing from constituents in Iowa's 2nd District?
It is. And this really has been referred to often as a vote of conscience. There are a lot of – almost every vote that I take, or the vast majority of votes I take sure, I have to think about what I think about this, what my conscience tells me, but I have to pay particular attention to my constituents and also the broader interests of the United States. In this case, I have to be thinking seriously about it myself, and having taught international politics for so many years at Cornell College, having traveled overseas a number of times myself, I have to be thinking long and hard, as you said, about the practical aspects of this as well. So there are a lot of things that I have to take into account when I think about what my vote is going to be on this.
Mm-hmm. Given the public opinion in the country and in your district, which you've talked about, mm-hmm. can you see a circumstance, anything that the president, that Secretary Kerry can say that will convince you have your vote in support of the president for military action in Syria?
Well, I've said all along that two conditions have to be met, and that is the American public and certainly people in my district have to be in favor of this action. And I think Congress has to be in favor of this action as well. But I also have to be convinced, as you said, on a practical level, that what is being proposed will in fact have the effect that it's intended to have.
Finally, before we wrap up on Syria and move to some other issues facing Congress, what difference does it make that the president came to Congress for this authorization How do you feel about that? How does it change the equation in Washington?
I'm not sure how it changes the equation, because it may very well be the case that the president will engage in this action, whether Congress approves of the resolution or not.
And he has the constitutional right to do so, does he?
I'm not convinced of that under the War Powers Act. This is not a national emergency. This is not a threat, as far as I'm concerned, to our national security interests. I know that argument is being made, but that argument has not been made effectively enough for me to accept that argument. So I think there's a real question on that front. At the same time, I am very happy that he came to Congress. I think that was the right thing to do. I signed a bipartisan letter last week calling on the president to do just that. So I am happy that he has come to Congress and asked for authorization.
Okay. So would you be supportive, and it doesn't look likely, but of a UN action rather than a U.S. Going it alone on Syria?
Well, somebody suggested that yesterday that although it's probably impossible to get a UN Security Council mandate because Russia and perhaps even China would veto such a mandate in the UN Security Council, but I think it's a good idea to go to the UN General Assembly and to try to get a vote of approval in the UN General Assembly. Again, if that happens, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to be in favor of this action.
Okay. If you just joined us, Representative Dave Loebsack of Iowa's 2nd District is my guest for this half hour. We're checking in with our elected, our congressional delegation before they return to Washington next week after the summer break. A very busy, as we've indicated, Congressman Loebsack, a very busy time, few months we have ahead, you have ahead of you, and we have as a country to think about issues and weigh in with our representatives. Let's talk about the farm bill stalled out. Where does the farm bill stand at this point?
Right now, it's difficult to say whether we're going to get anything passed by September 30th, which is the deadline for the extension that we passed last year. We have to think a little bit about the history of this, and going back last year, recall that this bill did not get passed last year either, so there was an extension that was granted that was passed until September 30th. At that time, a number of us were pressing very hard to get something passed. We needed, and we continue to need, to have a five-year farm bill. There needs to be changes, for example, getting rid of direct payments, substituting that with crop insurance as a backstop, as a safety net for our farmers. I think that makes a lot of sense. But last summer, it didn't happen. The House of Representatives, of course, was stymied on that. This summer, we've seen the very same thing happen again. I think it's quite unfortunate. We have a little bit different dynamic this time, in the sense that while there were opponents to the farm bill that was voted on initially this summer on both sides of the aisle, the primary opposition has come from those sophomore and freshmen, more Tea Party-oriented Republicans who simply don't like government, period. They want to see much greater cuts to the nutrition title, to SNAP, to food stamps.
What's wrong with decoupling that from the subsidies, the crop insurance for the farmers? Why not take those as separate issues?
That's a great question. And the answer, again, I think is primarily practical. We've had these two combined in the past, mainly to get a political coalition together to pass five-year farm bills when we've been able to do that. If you look at the Iowa delegation, whether it's Chuck Grassley on the Republican side or Tom Harkin on the Democratic side, or Dave Loebsack and Bruce Braley on the Democratic side, and Tom Latham and Steve King on the Republican side, and there are a lot of differences among us, as you well know. We are all of the same belief that it's only practical to have these together. That's the only way we're actually going to get something passed. There is a strong movement afoot, especially in the House, to separate these two. And when I go back, there's likely to be a vote either next week or the week after on even further draconian cuts to the SNAP program. Not $20 billion, not $35 billion that the Paul Ryan budget calls for, but $40 billion. And you asked, what are the prospects for getting something done? When one side is moving dramatically in the opposite direction from the other, that doesn't give me a lot of hope for compromise. Compromise results from the sides moving together. And right now I see that side moving away, and that's unacceptable. I think it's holding our farmers hostage, essentially.
So what is your forecast as to what will happen at the end of the month?
Well, it may be the case that that draconian bill, those cuts, $40 billion in cuts to SNAP, the food stamps, it may be that that very well passes the House. I, of course, will vote against that. It may be that that passes the House, and then there may be prospects for a conference committee for the Senate and the House to get together. And hopefully, I know some are predicting, but hopefully we can get something done by mid-October. I'm not saying that's going to happen. That would be good. But I'm going to stand firm on those massive cuts because I don't think that makes any sense.
If a farm bill doesn't pass, what's the outcome? What will happen with the farmers now? What are they looking at?
Well, the farmers have some time to be thinking about this with respect to the planting season and buying their inputs, their fertilizer, and all the rest. But we can't wait much longer at all. And I would suspect that it could be the case that we're going to have another extension of the previous farm bill, and we're not going to have the kind of reforms that we need to have in agriculture.
A couple of other things we want to talk about before our time ends. We have 5 or so minutes left here. In mid-October, the U.S. is set to hit the debt ceiling, requiring congressional action to stave off what would, by many people's accounts, be a disastrous default. Before that, Congress needs to pass at least a short-term spending bill to prevent government shutdown at the end of September. And it's a measure many Republicans say they'll refuse to take unless President Obama agrees to defund or delay implementation of his health care law. Where do you see this showdown going?
I hope there isn't a showdown. It's not good for the country. It's not good for our economy. As you know, we're in a recovery, but it's a very weak recovery. We can't jeopardize that economic recovery. And all that uncertainty that Republicans and Democrats alike talk about and that should be avoided will just be intensified if there is this showdown, whether it's on the debt ceiling or whether it's on the budget. It simply doesn't make any sense. I get around to my 24 counties every weekend when I'm back and during these extended district work periods that we've been on now for 5 weeks. The business community in particular tells me over and over again, this doesn't make any sense. The business community, many of whom are with Republicans, as you might imagine, when it comes to the elections, they're saying this is the wrong way to go. I'm listening to those folks. I agree with them. It's the wrong way to go. So I think that certainly the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. I voted for it. There are a lot of really good provisions there. I think it's really the wrong course of action for folks to take to try to continue to defund it. It doesn't make any sense. It's only going to delay implementation, which to me is unacceptable. There are certain things that the president has done to delay implementation, as you know, trying to take into account concerns of some folks out there in the economy. But to do this and to hold really our economy hostage, I think that's the wrong way to go. And I hope they don't continue down that path.
Let's talk about the National Flood Center. You've reintroduced your proposal for a National Flood Center, and we're reminded of it again this year with the strange weather that we had, the spring with all the rains filling the banks of our rivers. And now look at us here in late summer, in the fall, we're bone dry in many drought conditions declared across many parts of the state. Tell us about what you envision in your proposal for a National Flood Center and why it's so important now.
Well, I'm very proud of the work that folks here at the Flood Center have done at the University of Iowa, and that was established a number of years ago now, basically by the Iowa legislature, and really is a wonderful flood center. They get around the state of Iowa. They're doing a lot. They've done a lot with smaller communities and larger communities here in the state in terms of flood mitigation and dealing not only with flood mitigation, but looking at the long-term effects of the kind of climate change that we've seen and the other changes that we've seen in this country over time, whether it's development, whatever the case may be. And that's the idea, is to have a research center that is comprehensive. It looks at the causes of the floods. It looks at how we can prevent flooding down the road. And it would be national in scope. It wouldn't just be focused on Iowa. It would be coast to coast in that sense. I'm hopeful that I'm going to get folks on board on this from around the country in the House of Representatives and hopefully in the Senate as well, because I think it's absolutely essential that we have a research center so we understand the causes, whether it's climate change or sociological factors or economic factors, whatever the case may be. I think we've got to understand this in its totality so that we can deal with it in a long-term, comprehensive kind of way as well.
What do you think, then, are the chances of your proposal getting approval now when it failed in the first attempt?
Well, what I'm trying to do is talk to folks on the committee that's dealing with the Water Resources Development Act, and I'm doing what I can to get all or part of it into that bill once that gets through the House of Representatives. I feel confident that if that happens, that we can get something done on this front, and I'm just working as hard as I can. We're working both sides of the aisle, because as I like to say, floods don't make a distinction between Democrats and Republicans. Floods hit everyone, and we have folks in congressional districts all around the country who are Democrats and Republicans, and I think a lot of them are going to be receptive to this.
How does climate change fit into this? We, of course, want to understand all the causes. This flood-centered, as you said, to understand all the intricacies of weather, the ground processes that we can understand this. But climate change has really thrown in another factor here. What about addressing that issue?
That has to be addressed. There's no question. Serious scientists know that climate change is, in fact, occurring. And so that has to be a part of this. There's no question about that. We have to take into account other things like watershed management. I think taking a comprehensive approach on a watershed front makes a lot of sense as well. There are folks, for example, in Kelowna who are trying to do what they can along the English River, you know, develop a watershed approach there as well, because they've seen so many problems with that river. And we've seen smaller projects like the Soap Creek watershed, which is in the southwest part of my district, Davis and Appanoose County. I think we can learn from those folks who've done this on a smaller scale and apply that on a larger scale. So there are a lot of things we need to be taking into account.
What about a carbon tax? Are you in favor of that?
I've been looking at that. I'm not at this time. I think we have to be very careful when it comes to taxation of the American people, especially when we're in a situation where we're in a weak economic recovery. I think we have to be very careful that we don't dampen demand at this point. So, you know, clearly that's something that's on the table, and I'm looking at that, and I'll be giving that serious consideration. But at this point, I haven't signed on to that legislation.
Okay, as we know, last session, the Senate worked, acted on immigration. They came up with a bill. How do you see that moving, if at all, in the House? Is immigration dead, especially because so much attention will be given now to the question in Syria?
I think from a political standpoint, the good news is that virtually everyone out there in Washington, D.C., in Congress understands that our immigration system is broken. That's a start. Now, when it comes to the Senate bill, I have said good things about the Senate bill. I think that's a start. I think it's a good start. When it comes to the House, I think what's going to happen there and what's already begun to happen is that the Republican majority, and they're in the leadership, they're breaking it up into different parts. And we'll see how that turns out. The Senate went, I think, some distance in terms of the enforcement part of this. It's a lot of money to spend, $46 billion essentially to build a wall along the border. But that may be something that has to be a part of a final package. But I think we've got to do everything we can to make sure that we continue on our economic recovery here. That's a big part of this consideration, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, and clearly, you know, our system is broken, and we've got to bring people out of the shadows.
What about this very contentious issue of whether to include a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants? Do you see that in some way getting through the House at this point?
I think there's a good chance for that, because I think what you see is not only Democrats, but a lot of Republicans and a lot in the Republican leadership who are speaking in favor of that. Clearly, the start of that has to be some kind of a Dream Act where we allow those young folks who were brought here really by their parents or other folks, make sure that they can have the opportunities that they deserve. They came here through no fault of their own, and there's a lot of bipartisan support for that.
Okay. We want to thank you for joining us. I'm looking down here at my notes. Congress has 9 working days in September, 14 days in October, 8 days in November, another 8 in December. A lot to do, Congressman Loebsack. I appreciate you coming into our studio today to share some thoughts with us, Congressman Loebsack of Iowa 2nd District. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa's access to and adoption of high-speed internet is lagging. The TechNet State Broadband Index rates Iowa 11th out of 12 Midwestern states based on adoption of broadband, available network speeds, and internet industry jobs. And that's why this week Governor Branstad unveiled Connect Every Iowan. It's an initiative to extend high-quality internet access to the entire state. Branstad says a committee will identify roadblocks to broadband access and recommend ways to remove those roadblocks through public-private partnerships. He says it's an issue important for creating jobs.
For each additional percentage of broadband penetration, we can expect employment to increase by up to 0.3% each year. This will be a key factor in continuing to grow our economy and putting Iowans back to work.
Connect Iowa is a public-private partnership between the Iowa Economic Development Authority and Connected Nation. It aims to increase broadband access, adoption, and use across the state. Joining us now, Amy Coolers, State Program Manager for Connect Iowa. Welcome to our program, Amy.
Thank you. It's great to be here today.
Let's talk about what the governor did this week. What makes this initiative so important for our state?
Economic development is of course, an issue. We watch some of these larger players who have been coming into the state, Microsoft, Google, Facebook most recently, opening these data centers. You know, those are a draw to our state. And we know that in a lot of, you know, some of our rural communities that maybe don't have the same type of access, it is a jobs issue for some companies where they're going to locate if they don't have the access that they need. And then a lot of our schools are starting with the one-to-one initiatives where every school has a device. So if you don't have adequate connectivity at home, you're not at the same playing field as maybe your other students in your class that do have that connectivity.
The TechNet State Broadband Index ranks Iowa as really close to the end, last place in terms of 12 Midwestern states, 11th out of 12 Midwestern states based on adoption of broadband, the available network speeds, and internet industry jobs. How did Iowa get into this lagging position?
Relevance is the biggest barrier in the state of Iowa right now, and that's different in other states. But in addition, one of the things that they look at is this number of internet-related jobs. And as a component of that, they look at the number of jobs that are directly related to mobile applications, so those applications you use on your smartphone and on your tablet devices. And I think we're starting to see more and more of these startup entrepreneurial communities within communities that are really on the forefront of applications management. They're building these applications. And I think those jobs are going to increase, and I think just even with the bringing in the new data centers and knowing that the connectivity is here and they're using those, I think you're going to start seeing a big uptick in technology, computer-related jobs as well.
So maybe you can tell me in 5 or 10 years what our state will look like in terms of broadband access and getting people to adopt that.
I would love to say in 5 years we will have a nearly totally connected state for all of those individuals who want to connect. So that means we would have access and adequate speed levels to everybody in the state that wanted to subscribe. And then you have to look at the adoption. And I would hope that there is enough solid education programs and that there's enough solid uses, exciting uses, that people are they're wanting to adopt broadband because it will bring a quality of life to them. I want to see us connected enough in some of our rural communities that people can start to look at telecommuting as a very viable option. I'd like to see new businesses coming into the state, and not just in our metro areas, but also in our rural areas as well.
Amy Coolers, State Program Manager for Connect Iowa, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this half hour we're talking about broadband access and its adoption, the so-called digital divide in this country when it comes to the haves and the have-nots in terms of high-speed internet connections and access. Also talking about Connect Every Iowan, a new initiative announced by the governor this week to extend high-quality internet access to the entire state. Joining us now, Carolyn Tolbert, Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Tolbert is the author, together with Karen Mossberger and William Franco, of a new book called Digital Cities, The Internet and the Geography of Opportunity. Professor Tolbert, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's first, if I can ask you to react a little bit to the initiative announced by the governor this week, Connect Every Iowan.
This is an exciting crossroads for the state of Iowa. This is something that is a nonpartisan issue that Republicans and Democrats, that those in education and health and the business community should be getting behind. And it's it's very important that Iowa is recognizing that without high-speed internet access that is available, affordable, and accessible to all Iowans, that Iowa will not be able to be competitive in the 21st century for a digital Iowa, a digital nation. This initiative is following initiatives in other states. In Illinois, there's the Partnership for Connected Illinois. In Cleveland, in Ohio, there's One Community. And so this is, I see, very important.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen that in statistics, and I'm glad you mentioned Illinois, other Midwestern states, that Iowa's actually lagging behind in this area, high-speed internet access, quality access to the internet, among Midwestern states. Any idea why that would be?
Well, part of what our work has shown is that the barriers to internet access and use vary for different regions of the country, and Iowa has more rural areas than other parts of the country, so that a lack of infrastructure is part of the problem. But there are also barriers. Research has shown that older populations tend to be the least likely to have regular internet access and use it. Iowa has one of the oldest populations demographically. And in terms of the urban centers in Iowa, we also have economic inequality, and we have one of the fastest growing Latino populations. Latinos tend to be the least likely to be online, to have internet access and use. So for lots of barriers that have to do with cost, a lack of interest, affordability, English language skills, and a lack of infrastructure, you can see those can add up to create inequalities in access and use for the state.
The United Nations has declared access to the internet a human right. And in your new book, Digital Cities, you put it a bit differently. You argue that in the 21st century, digital literacy is as important as literacy was in the 19th century. Explain that.
And this actually is, this argument is developed in our 2008 book called Digital Citizenship, where we argue that access to the prevailing form of communication is necessary for full participation in society. During the 19th century, if you were unable to read, you would not be able to participate in politics, to be able to vote. You wouldn't have a quality of economic opportunity. You'd have a hard time applying for a job and getting a good paying job. You wouldn't be able to read a prescription bottle or be able to access healthcare information. And today, in the 21st century, as much of our important economic, political, and health information has migrated online, if you are excluded from access to information online, you are also excluded from full participation in society. So we, consistent with the United Nations, believe that all Americans should have access to the internet and have the skills to use the internet, to be able to be digital citizens, which we define as individuals who go online daily and use the internet for human capital activities. This is not gaming, texting, and other kinds of entertainment, watching videos, but rather these are activities such as healthcare information, using the internet to apply for a job, for work, using the internet for transportation, using the internet for important civic and community and political participation, the things that are required to be an equal citizen in society.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this digital literacy and the importance that you just described is as widely recognized in the country as it should be?
The data shows, much of the data is based on what we call broadband infrastructure maps. So those are maps that show the internet is available to X amount of the population. In the city of Chicago, for example, that would be 99.9% of the population. However, our research maps something very different, which is what is the actual percentage of the population in neighborhoods across Chicago that actually have high-speed internet at home or who have internet on their mobile phones. And there we see dramatic inequality from very poor neighborhoods and high Latino and high African American and just high poor neighborhoods, where you might see 40 to 45% of the population actually has high speed at home, to neighborhoods up near the Michigan Mile, affluent neighborhoods where 98% of the population is online. So there's one of the things we're trying to do is highlight not where the internet is available to purchase, but the actual percentage of the population that is online and where that geographic inequality lies.
Talk also, you described the urban area, Chicago. You've studied where we have a dense population. The other end of the spectrum, we have rural areas. Iowa has a lot of rural areas. And you write that rather than promoting innovation or addressing the high cost of broadband access, the U.S. has mostly funded expensive rural infrastructure in sparsely populated areas.
Part of Obama's stimulus spending in 2008 to get the economy back on track included a significant investment in broadband infrastructure. And part of what our book talks about is that if you actually look at where that money was spent, about 90% of the money went to offsetting the cost of laying high-speed fiber cable in more rural areas, and a much smaller percent, less than 10%, went to funding initiatives to expand broadband in suburban and urban areas. It turns out that in America right now, 84% of Americans live in metropolitan areas.
So you're saying that was misplaced? The ratio was a little too lopsided?
Well, it was not an efficient use of the money if what you want to do is get more people online, because a critical barrier even in Iowa itself, 80% of the population lives in suburban or urban areas. And there are three barriers to why people aren't online that you can see from the research. And obviously one is that it's not available, that you can't purchase it. But that actually affects a very small percentage of the population that are primarily in rural areas that aren't accessed. A second barrier is that people say they're not interested, and that would largely affects older populations. But a primary barrier that we see in the data that affects at least half the people who say they're offline or more is that they either can't afford it or they don't have access to a computer or a mobile phone, which is a form of not affording it, to be able to get online. And the federal government program only addressed the lack of availability. Mm-hmm. It didn't address affordability or cost.
If you've just joined us, Carolyn Tolbert is my guest in this portion of River to River, professor of political science at the University of Iowa. We're talking about the so-called digital divide, and she is a co-author of a new book, Digital Cities, the Internet and the Geography of Opportunity. You mentioned mobile devices. Doesn't that make up for the fact that you might not have internet access in your phone, in your home?
One of the primary ways of bringing high-speed internet to more rural and sparsely populated areas is not laying fiber optic cable, but rather it's using wireless devices and wireless internet. And that will likely be the more efficient, cost-efficient way to provide access to parts of Iowa right now that are not covered. One of the greatest criticisms of those who argue that the government should play a role in expanding internet access and expanding, importantly, also skills to use the internet. And we argue in our work that you both, in order to be a digital citizen, you need high-speed access, but you also need the skills to use this medium effectively. But mobile is something that when people argue the problem's going to solve itself, don't worry about it.
Right.
The TV spread to most households. The telephone spread to most
households. We don't need
households.
To regulate it. Let it spread.
Let
the market take care of it.
Right. And one of the reasons why we've seen a leveling off is because the costs associated with using the internet are monthly charges. This is not a one-time fee. And in fact, there's always an increasing hierarchy of more expensive costs. So now we all want fiber to our home, which will cost double. But so the mobile revolution has been significant, is that among African Americans, Latinos, the young, and especially the poor, they are predominantly mobile internet access. So for many of these populations, they're more likely to have smartphones or internet on their phones than other segments of the population. You can see more. So we see these groups are more likely to have mobile phones and internet on their phone, and they're more likely to rely exclusively on mobile internet access.
Are you implying that if you rely exclusively effectively on mobile internet access that you're not fully digitally literate?
Right. So doing work for a job, finding healthcare information, reading the news online, taking a class online, and your probability of doing these reading an entire book online, and your probability of doing these if you have only a mobile device is much lower than if you have home high-speed internet. Obviously, having a keyboard is much more limited. Being able to access forms is much more difficult. And the gaps are very significant. If you have home high-speed internet, you're about 20 to 25% have a higher probability, say, of banking online, using online banking, or taking a class online, doing work for a job. Among the mobile-only population, we see higher rates of texting, of gaming, of the entertainment activities. And there is much promise from mobile devices. But from our work and others, it is not a substitute for having high-speed access. And in fact, now, if you want to be a fully connected citizen, it requires both mobile internet and high speed at home. And this is the new bar that we can see.
To bring this conversation full circle back to the governor's initiative announced this week, what do you see as the way forward? What advice would you give to the people working on the governor's new Connect Every Iowan initiative?
There, we really have to think of a multiple forked kind of policy that addresses these differential populations and the differential needs that they face. So clearly, one problem is bringing access to rural areas of the state that are right now cannot purchase high-speed access. That might involve working with providers to create new high-speed towers to bring mobile access to these areas of the state. As I said, fiber is costly, and the laying the internet cable is costly. But what I would argue has been critical, and critical in the states that we see some of our book, Digital Cities, ranks the 50 cities, the 50 largest cities by those who are the most connected and the least connected. And if you go look at some of the tables, you'll see some usual suspects that in Seattle and in San Francisco and in Austin, Texas, despite varying economic, affluent and poor, racial and ethnic minorities, these are very highly connected cities where large majorities of the population are online. And yet, if you go to Buffalo or Cleveland or Detroit or other cities, the numbers are literally half. These are the non-digital cities. These are the cities lagging behind. And what our research shows is that if you are young, if you are poor, if you are a minority, and you live in a highly connected area, you have a much higher probability of being a digital citizen, being online, that it's not just individual factors, it's the context in which you live. And so what Iowa wants to do is it wants to join the group of the digital cities and the digital states. So what we've seen is they've taken this issue very seriously. They have worked on policy. They've worked with nonprofits. They've passed legislation. They've acknowledged that affordability and cost is a barrier to people being offline, as well as a lack of basic infrastructure. And this, so if I had to say one thing to the group, it would be make sure that we recognize affordability, cost, lack of skills, including language skills for immigrant, for Latino immigrant communities, are addressed, training is addressed, as well as infrastructure.
And one of the barriers that you didn't address in those final comments, people just not interested in it. Do we not do anything about that group? Can we do anything about that group?
So we have been working with the City of Chicago since 2008, the Partnership for Connected Illinois, and first with Mayor Daley, who held a press conference based on our research, and now with Rahm Emanuel. And we have mapped internet access across neighborhoods. The federal government provided money for what are called smart communities, and nine neighborhoods of Chicago's 77 were, quote, treated with initiatives that were community-based initiatives to create smart communities. They included public computing centers, training centers, classes for both young people, for business entrepreneurs, for older people, and the use of technology was integrated into everything the community wanted to do, whether it would be start small businesses or or educate young people or help people find jobs. And our work then, we were just, an article on our work was just written up in the New York Times and cited our study, but it showed some preliminary evidence that those nine smart communities that had a higher rate of people getting online than the other Chicago communities that didn't have these training programs. And remember, these initiatives in Chicago provided public access and training, but they didn't actually give money to individuals to have high-speed access. And one of the ways that they got people interested is they showed them the vast array of things that they could do online. It turns out the number one request in these smart communities was from small business owners to help create a web page. And you wouldn't imagine that that would be the number one request. They help show Latino populations how to use Skype so that they could make free phone calls to their relatives in Mexico without the very high charges. So if you show people how they can use the internet to do what they need to more efficiently, more cost effectively, you can overcome the interest barriers, lots of things.
Carolyn Tolbert, professor of political science at the University of Iowa, co-authored together with Karen Mossberger and William Franco of the new book, Digital Cities, The Internet and the Geography of Opportunity. Professor Tolbert, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.